Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me on the other end of our wonderful technology, computer/phone line, is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Yeah, it's amazing what we have today, isn't it?
It is.
Compared
I know.
To yesterday.
I mean, you started doing radio in the 70s, right?
Right.
Things have changed a bit, haven't they?
You think? Yes, I think so.
You don't even have to leave your home now, and we can create a radio show.
That's right.
That's right. Well, Mom, who is our guest today?
Well, today is our Lucy Antek Jonathan, and she has written a book. Well, anyway, you'll see, it's complicated. But this was Toscanini, The Maestro, My Father and Me is the title of this book. And part of the authors, one of the authors was her father, Samuel, of course. That's going to be explained. I just want to tell you, this is amazing. This really is. She was born and raised in New York City after studying music, fine art and ballet. She was drawn to the world of television production and spent her entire career in the entertainment industry, producing movies for television before joining the ranks of NBC as a network executive. She soon worked her way up to senior vice president of daytime and children's programs for CBS. She and her husband, Bill Klein, live in Connecticut. Welcome to the program.
Well, what a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
So, Lucy, now with that, with knowing your background, now I understand why your audiobook is so amazing. Because
it is
more than just an audiobook. It is a production. So,
yeah.
So I'm sure you had a lot to do with that.
I was a one man, one person, one woman, whatever you'd say, band here. I did it all on my computer that I'm talking to you now.
Oh my gosh.
And in a studio at the local library. So I sort of did it all myself, but I want to just say I'm the biggest fan of radio and have grown up on radio. I still listen to radio all the time. I love, love, love radio. So this is a thrill for me to do a radio show for you.
That is, well, we're thrilled to have you. So your father, Samuel Antek, was in the NBC Orchestra.
Symphony Orchestra.
Which was conducted by Arturo Toscanini. And what years was that?
Well, the orchestra was formed in 1937. David Sarnoff, who was the head of RCA, which is the company that then owned NBC Radio, wanted to start a radio orchestra and make it one of the best in the world, of course. And at that time, which was the rumblings of World War II, and Europe had certainly already, you know, been listening to Hitler and Mussolini, Arturo Toscanini, who was a world famous musician, was living in his home in Italy and was being more than harassed, but sometimes beaten up by the fascists. And he had stood up against both Hitler and Mussolini to say, I will not bend to your demands of me as an artist. And he refused to play the fascist anthem, and they made life very, very difficult for him. So when he got the invitation at the age of 70 to come to New York to create his own orchestra and be the conductor, they couldn't have foreseen, how wonderful, that it would be a 17-year span of time. So at the age of 70, when most people are retiring, he started a long-awaited orchestra that then became world-renowned called the NBC Symphony Orchestra. And my father was one of the original members as a violinist.
Wow. And your father then became very well known in his own right.
Yes, he was a violinist, certainly, you know, at that point, and his dream had been to conduct. And he pursued that dream, and he was rewarded for that dream. While he maintained his position as first violinist of the NBC Symphony through the whole span of time till 1954, when Toscanini retired at the age of 87, he began his own conducting career with the support and enthusiasm of the maestro. So he had two parallel musical careers. And he was named, 1947, he was named musical director, conductor of the New Jersey Symphony. And in that tenure, he created a format for children's concerts, which had not been done before in this way, long before Leonard Bernstein, I might add. And that format, he was welcomed all around the country to do children's concerts for young people at different national orchestras. So he had his own orchestra, and then he was made director of children's concerts at Philadelphia, and he became assistant conductor to Fritz Reiner in Chicago, and he guest conducted all around the country, and even was invited by Toscanini to guest conduct the NBC Symphony on a few occasions. So he was a rising star until he died very young.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So tell us how this book came to be.
Well, it was...
Well, the original... talk about the original book.
Yeah, there were three iterations. it's so far has only had three lives. The first life was the original memoir. I call it a musical memoir, which is most of what this book still remains, is my father's narration and my father's voice telling his story of what it was like to work for the great legendary maestro as a musician in his orchestra. You have to understand that at that time, in the early 50s, when my father was writing it, Toscanini was still considered a rock star in today's parlance. He was world famous, and people always wanted to know, what is he really like? What is he really like? And they would be glued to their radios or to their phonographs, listening to records, or in the latter years to some television concerts. And he was renowned not only for his musical brilliance, but for his changing moods, let's say, in rehearsal. And so the curiosity about him was very deep, not just from a musical standpoint, but from a human interest standpoint. So my father wrote many articles about him, and he got approached by a publisher to put that into book form. He died suddenly just before he completed the book. He had completed all his chapters, but he never did a final wrap-up chapter. So my mother, who was an artist and a pianist, not a writer, my father was a very good writer, I believe, was told or asked by the publisher, please, we still want to publish. There's still so much interest about him. Can you complete this for us, and we will help you edit it and so forth? And she said yes. It took a few years, and she joined forces with a man named Robert Hupka, who was a photographer but also had been a engineer at RCA recording division and had been present at every recording session and every rehearsal, no less every concert, of those 17 years of the NBC Symphony, and had taken hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of photos of the maestro in action, candid pictures, that my mother and Robert put together in this particular book that ultimately was published in 1963 posthumously. And it was a perfect marriage of artistic efforts. the stories and these photographs, which were used as illustrations rather than just a clump of photographs in the middle, throughout illustrating the text, and got excellent notices at the time, New York Times, etc. And through the years has become a classic and renowned because it has was then and remains the only full-length narrative, full-length being the operative word here, of what it was like to be a musician working with this maestro, this genius, musical genius. And so it has remained. And in 2017, see, I am bringing it up to date. In 2017, it was the 150th anniversary of Toscanini's birth. And that meant many articles and new books were written about his legacy. And one of the pieces that struck me so was a new book then by Harvey Sachs, who's a musical historian and Toscanini historian. He had just finished a new biography, and it was called Toscanini, Musician of Conscience. And it refers a lot to the political things that I mentioned before. And in it, he used many paragraphs from my dad's book. Those quotes were used in many articles throughout the years, but this was got a lot of attention. And it even appeared in a New Yorker article, which is where I first came across it. And I said, gee, you know, I've had this book on my coffee table for umpteen decades, and I remember it being written, and I remember the putting the book together, and I remember when it was published, but I'm going to reread it. And so in 2017 and 2018 is when I reread it, and I said, this has to come back, because it was out of print. And I said, this is timeless. Great art is timeless. And this is about process. And this is a behind the scenes peek at something through a musician's eyes. And how do I bring this back to appeal to new generations of musicians, students, and enthusiasts? And Harvey and he became a very close friend, Harvey Sachs. And I just started in, and I talked to my attorney because I had to check on the rights. And he said, I suggest you do a new copyright, but you would have to add pieces. You would have to add things or take away. I wasn't going to take away. So he said, if you put together what would be technically called, I suppose, a new work, then we can get a whole new copyright and it has a whole new life. So I sat down. I said, oh, my dear, what do I do? What do I do? Well, more than just changing out some photographs or putting in some more family photographs, I said, I am going to shine a spotlight on my dad. Because in the original book, in his original memoir, which is first person, he doesn't talk about himself very much. He's focused on the music and on the maestro. So I said, this is an opportunity for me to write about our life together, but also to write about his career and how the maestro and working with the NBC Symphony influenced his career and influenced our family life. Because I had, you know, Toscanini was, he doesn't know it necessarily, but he was a member of our family, you know, ever since I could remember. I was born quite a few years after the NBC Symphony was formed, but it was part of our life and part of our culture. So I started writing. I am not a professional writer. I've been taking memoir workshops for 20 years. So I had a handle on how to express myself through words. I've worked with writers my whole career, helping them shape their projects, whether it was a script or an idea or anything that was in writing. It was part of my job to help work with them on their projects. But I had never been tasked to do something on my own. So I worked with an editor, and I would write the pieces, And I figured out, well, I'll tell this in intro to chapter one, and I'll tell this much. And so throughout, there are seven pieces. I not only talk about my experience in growing up in that household, but also I develop my dad's career, and I try to always, and I think I succeeded, always still make it an introduction to his original to my dad's original chapter, so that the reader, or in this case, listener with the audiobook, I'm guiding them into that original experience, but I'm doing it with some kind of personal reflections. And that got published in 2021. And I was just, couldn't have been more pleased with the look of the book, the quality of the book, and the reception, because as I said, I'm not a professional writer, and I'm good at memos, and I'm good at I'm good at editing notes, and I'm good at putting presentations together, but I was not, and also a memoir can be tricky. And I learned through all my workshops over the years, which I love, tell the truth. And first, you have to know what the truth is. And think about it.
That is tricky, isn't it?
And think about it and go a little below just the story that you've heard, because sometimes our memories are not reliable. And I spent hours and hours and hours at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center, going through my dad's archives, which I had donated and, of course, had looked through. But now I sat there with a whole new set of eyes, reading letters and looking at photos with the eye of, how did this feel? What did it mean to me? Do I remember that moment? Or is it just a photograph I remember? All of those layers, and tried to tell mini stories in each of these chapter introductions. And then I have what I call a prelude, which is an introduction and a coda at the end, a little bit, which I'll read later. And so that for me was an extraordinarily satisfying process. Last year.
So that was number two.
Yeah, check. Very pleased with the production of the book, the actual look of it, and the reception to it. And I'm dealing with a very niche audience. You know, I'm not John Grisham here.
Right.
And I didn't expect that, I didn't know what to expect, to tell you the truth. But it, among the musical community, it was very well received, because it was also still mostly my dad's original book. And I had been concerned, maybe my writing style will be jarring compared to my dad's. But working with an editor helped bring that up, that we were, I can't say I'm not an equal to him, but it wasn't a jarring experience. Then I said last summer, just about this time, this lends itself to an audiobook. The stories, the musical analysis, and the stories, and my father's style, which I found very accessible and easy to be caught up into, plus adding some musical cues, because we don't have photographs on audiobooks. I said, oh dear, how am I going to bring this to life? Well, of course, there had to be music. Not so easy. Mm-hmm. Not so easy. First of all, you have to have access to this, to the rights. And even with all the internet stuff that's floating around, I felt honor bound to the estate and to my father's legacy, and to the publisher of the book, and the same publisher, Brown Books, who's going to release this as an audiobook, that I had done made all the right steps, and I worked with my attorney. And I got in touch with the Toscanini estate, who I had been in touch with over the years and who were very big fans of this property. What could I use that isn't under wraps as musical sequences? What body of work? Is there a list that you could get me? And I will make sure I fit it in. I want to use 30 seconds here, 45 seconds there. I'm not looking to do a record. I'm looking to do an audiobook with music as illustrations. And they told me what to do. And there was a list of like 20 performances that were not under other people's rights, that was under their domain. And from that, I found all of these. I had a lot of it on CDs and DVDs of, you know, already, thank goodness. And I had them digitized. I couldn't do that. I went to a person, a guy who knew a guy, a few miles away who had the equipment to digitize, put it on my computer, listened to each of these pieces, whether it was Mozart or Beethoven or Wagner, and started to make choices. Oh, this would be good for the opening of chapter 3. Oh, he talks about Verdi in chapter 4. I must use something from Verdi. All of which was luckily available to me through these pieces. And I had also worked with another source who had the rights to other pieces. And I spent hours and hours and days doing the timings, listening to each thing and figuring, oh, the first 33 seconds will be good and I'll fade it out here, et cetera, et cetera. So when I went into the studio and had completed my narration and my dear friend David Garrison's narration of my dad's chapters, which I think elevated the material even to another degree, the engineer and I had all the cues ready. And he, through his artistry and musical knowledge, we worked together to know how to fade it up, when to fade it out, let the musical phrase complete, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how this audiobook came to be. So, yes, it's a huge labor of love, but it was also a huge working process. And as a producer,
yes,
by training, it employed everything I've ever learned about producing something, because I was the producer, the director, the talent in some cases, and the musical director to make this. I just heard it in my head, and I, working with this engineer and having access to these particular pieces, which I was really lucky. How many times do you try to get in touch with somebody or call them or email them, and it could take weeks before they respond, if they do? In this case, the man I was calling answered the phone. I mean, when
Hallelujah.
Does that happen? So I didn't have to, you know, that part of it, getting the permissions, was actually the quicker part. I didn't expect that. It was the actual production of the audio that took the longest, and we completed it, you know, the end of the calendar year, and did some other things, and it was released a month ago. So that's my story. I can't say soon to be a major motion picture, but I'm just saying it had three lives, and each live enhanced the material.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. in the audiobook, yeah. well, in the book, there's a whole chapter where your father is describing a certain piece, the Oberon Overture,
yes,
that was played half a dozen times over the life during the
yes.
the time of the orchestra, and how, and some of the conducting decisions that Toscanini made and how he communicated it. Your friend who did the audio of that part, Did when he's doing Toscanini's voice, is it pretty accurate?
As it turns out, it is. we had long, David, his name is David Garrison, considering that most people haven't heard his voice, you can go to YouTube and hear it, mm. but, you know, you would have to, you know, delve into
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
But at the time, when one listened to a concert or watched a television concert of the NBC Symphony, he was conducting. It was music. It wasn't him talking to the audience or anything. He had a very significant accent, and David and I worked on that. And David's an actor. David's a musical theater performer. So in his ear, he worked on this narration as though he were going on Broadway, but he worked very hard on emphasis and meaning. And then we got to the accent, and I said, you know, we'd rather even it out rather than be too overt about it. At the same time, he had an accent.
Mm-hmm.
And he learned over time to speak English much more fluently than he did at the very beginning. But he communicated so well to his musicians. On top of that, he spoke Italian quite often and would when he was upset, or which was kind of often, or you know, he would break out into an Italian phrase, and one of them being vergogna, which means shame, which I as a kid heard all the time, and I would run around the house yelling vergogna, vergogna. But he would when he was excited or frustrated, he would use Italian quite often. And David, hopefully, I hope you think, I believe, he got the mood right.
Oh, yeah.
He got the intensity right. And he just about captured the personality of the maestro. There are, you know, you can go on YouTube and hear him. So it's not that off from what he was. But the average listener doesn't really know it. But we didn't make it up. Right.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Lucy Ann Tech Johnson, author, well, co-author of This Was Toscanini, The Maestro, My Father, and Me. Now, Caroline, I know that you've been spending quite a bit of time with this book. Do you have some questions?
Yes. Yes, I was wondering, did your father keep a journal? There's so many details of things that happened on the travels, when they were traveling with the orchestra, and how the maestro reacted to things. I don't know how he kept track of all that. Did he keep diaries and things?
Yes and no. He was commissioned to write articles along the way, one of them being for Saturday Review, or he'd be interviewed about it, of what it was like to work with the maestro. So he kept his own notes. I wouldn't say they were formal journals. And letters, and so many photographs. So when he'd have to refer back to something, he had pretty much gotten it down. And no one has ever refuted that any of this isn't accurate. Because he was writing in order to be published, whether it be an article or this book. So he was doing his best to be accurate, but to also capture the moment. My mother, however, kept a journal on their South American tour in 1940 that I didn't even know we had. I don't even know, I'm sure my father knew she was writing, but she was just doing jottings of what it was like to be on this experience going by ship to South America with the symphony, where they were treated like royalty in 1940 before we got into the war. And I found that journal deep in a box, and so I could read her handwriting, and so enjoyed her humor throughout. But she, of course, wasn't writing it either to be read by me 60 years later, 70 years later. So I used a lot of her writings or experience on that tour to inform the introduction that I wrote to the touring chapter. He did not write about the South American tour, and I don't know why. Hmm. I absolutely just don't know why. Perhaps he was still writing and was going to add it. We'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find any notes, but finding her journal made a huge difference to me. Plus, I have a huge amount of photographs that they took because they were on their second, well, actually their first honeymoon. They had gotten married in 1939. So it was a combination, Caroline, of letters, his articles, his notes for his articles, and my mother's journal.
Okay. Well, it's amazing that you were able to put it all together and make this amazing, amazing book. And what was fantastic to me was that Toscanini had a photographic memory. And he
certainly did.
He
knew, I don't know, something like 250 pieces by memory, whether it be opera or classical pieces. And I don't know, it came to the surface when he, as a cellist, he was a trained cellist in Parma. And when he was a young, up-and-coming professional cellist, he was on tour in Brazil with an opera, touring opera company, an Italian, and the conductor of that company kind of got ill in the middle of the tour. And Toscanini, who had never really conducted, said, I know all of these operas by heart that we're going to do. Give me a shot. Give me a chance. And he conducted the rest of the tour. He was pretty good at it. So he never looked back. He then went on to be the conductor that we now know. But he didn't start out with that as a primary focus. And he then went on to be the conductor at La Scala and opera companies, and then obviously the, you know, all around the world, and the Metropolitan Opera and the New York Philharmonic, and then the NBC Symphony. A similar instance happened to my dad when he wanted to be a conductor. He was hired to do a violin solo on a radio program, a weekly radio music program. And that day, the day of the live performance, the conductor gets sick. And they turn to my dad. It's like a Hollywood movie. Then they turn to my dad, who they knew had conducting experience, but never was sought out for it. Would you at least do this live broadcast? We don't know how we'll get through it. He did. And he conducted the rest of the season for that radio show. So each of these musicians had the unexpected opportunity to discover and explore and then get fall in love with their conducting experiences and skills and talents, you know. So
well, I know people who aren't familiar with conducting don't realize that the conductor has to know exactly which instruments are supposed to play what, when, and how much, and softly or loudly, or when they're supposed to come in, and when they're, So imagine he had all that memorized. I mean, that was fantastic.
And unbelievable. So it's a photographic memory, but, you know, it's not just repeating what you know, it's how you interpret what you know.
Yeah.
And when I've talked to people, and I'll say it here, I liken to what a conductor does, because most people go, what does that mean? What does a conductor really do? Okay, 2-2, 4-4, 1-2, 3-4. No. Think of it as like a director of a film or a director of a play. They are the vision for how to take the writer's words, in this case, a composer's work, and interpret it. How loud is fortissimo? How soft is pianissimo? How do you interpret 4-4? Is it a slow 4? Is it a faster 4? You're interpreting with your, whether it's actors or in this case musicians, how to interpret a composer's work and how to bring it to what you hear in your mind's eye, or in this case mind's ear.
Mm-hmm.
And also honoring the composer's markings. And that was one of Toscanini's traits and claims to fame. And what he was noted for was, because you won't always know about Beethoven or Brahms, but by taking their markings and interpreting their works as best as he could, what he thought the composer intended. And he wasn't as interested in his own interpretation as honoring the composer and bringing his own musicianship to the process, and right. raising the level of artistry of the musicians or singers that he worked with. They, you know, it was always about honoring the music,
right, and rewarding the composer's intentions. So that was not always easy. I mean, gosh, what a genius!
And Verdi, Giuseppe Verdi, who had conducted Toscanini as a cellist. We have to. It's hard to like get this in your head. Has said to Toscanini, tells the story of how he had to help Toscanini as a cellist interpret what does forte mean, what does piano mean, what is, you know, piano mm-hmm. forte, etc. And so here was Verdi, the composer, and in this case the conductor of I think it was Otello, the opera, to Toscanini, who learned right from the man himself. So he lived through a very interesting era of composers. Brahms was still alive when Toscanini was born and started conducting, but that doesn't mean they were pals or knew each other. His thing was, I want to honor the music that the composer intended.
Wow. So, mm-hmm. Now, in this chapter where your father's going into such detail about how Oberon, the overture, was conducted, it's like there's this part where, at the very beginning, where Toscanini isn't really cueing the different sections on when to come in like you would normally expect a conductor to do. And right. In my limited experience playing in a band and, you know, in high school and stuff, I mean, that was sort of the main thing the conductor does, is point to the, you know, when you're supposed to come in. Now, your father wasn't at all like critical about Toscanini doing it differently, but what was his reasoning for that?
Well, that chapter, which is a bar by bar journey through Weber's Oberon Overture, and now we've added musical illustrations,
which
to
is
that.
Amazing. Yeah,
and that was hard because the text wasn't written to have specific places for music, so I had to figure that out. The opening bars, which is a horn solo, a very baleful horn solo, is a certain amount of bars on the sheet music, on the printed music, and then the violins come in. But how baleful, how long, how slow, how soft do the violins come in? That was, let's call it, the musical interpretation by the maestro. And he felt, I don't mean to be his spokesman, but through my father's words, that he had to feel it each time. He couldn't just, you know, point to the second violins and say, your turn. They too had to be part of this process. They had to listen to each other and feel it equally to what the maestro was feeling. And that doesn't mean that the first time always worked, as you read, because Toscanini was also finding his way through what feels right, what sounds right. A little more of this, please. A little more of that, please. But he was entrusting his artists, like you would an actor in a play, when you're directing a play or a movie, that they're bringing their own art to this moment. And so that was part of the reasoning. I would say you kind of have to read the whole chapter to understand where sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. You know, how to do a certain violin interpretation, and they would try out different bowing techniques. But that opening, which is very famous opening, not just because of Toscanini, but even other conductors, because it's that long horn solo followed by a very gentle entrance, because it's a, my word, gentle, I don't, you know, you can use whatever you want. And it turns out that the musician who was the horn player in that recording and in that orchestra, his son Ken Burv has become a friend.
So
it was the Burv brothers were the horn players in the symphony, and it's one of the Burv brothers who was playing that solo. So there were many anecdotes over the years about they were scared. They were, first of all, they were scared of him a little bit, that he'd scream and yell.
He was pretty intimidating, wasn't he?
He could be very intimidating. But what comes through in the book, and I have to believe it because the results are here, is as much as they could be a little put off or a little intimidated, they knew that all of Toscanini's intensity was in honor of the music, not because he wasn't getting his way. And there's a very big difference. You know, I want it this way. No, do it this way, because he heard it a certain way and it had to be that way. It was always in honor of the music. And that's what caused many, many of these players in the orchestra to rise up with their own artistry to meet that challenge. And they might have gone through a couple of tough moments with the maestro, but they were rewarded with a performance in the end that they felt good about, as well as that the maestro felt good about. Wow.
Lucy, why don't you read a little bit from your book for us?
I will. I'm going to read a little bit from the introduction to my father's first chapter. Then I will read a little from his chapter. And then I will do a little bit from my coda. I call it my wrap-up.
Perfect.
By the way, may I say, when you're listening to the audiobook, there's music throughout this, but I'm not going to hum anything for you.
You can't hum and talk at the same time.
No, I can't. I grew up in a home filled with music. One of my earliest memories was listening to my father practice his violin. I'd hover just outside of our living room, hoping to catch a glimpse of him with his violin perched under his chin. My father, Samuel Antek, was only 29 when he, already a recognized violin virtuoso, was handpicked to be a first violinist in the newly formed and highly anticipated NBC Symphony, an orchestra created especially for Arturo Toscanini, regarded as the greatest conductor of the modern age. This was Toscanini's not a biography, it's my father's musical memoir, his intimate behind-the-scenes portrait of the maestro and his creative process, told from the unique perspective of a musician who was fortunate enough to play under Toscanini's leadership for 17 years in almost 1,000 rehearsals, innumerable recording sessions, and hundreds of NBC Symphony concerts. Through Dad's writing, we feel as though we're sitting among the players of the orchestra, experiencing firsthand, as they experienced, what inspired the maestro's dynamic approach to a score, his conducting style, and what triggered his explosive moods and passions. So what was that first rehearsal with the maestro really like? Their first rehearsal for their premiere performance with one of the most famous men in the world. They were about to make history. Let's have my father's words tell the story. And now these are from his chapter. In the fall of 1937, a great symphony orchestra brought together from the far corners of the world sat in rapt and tingling silence on the huge stage of Studio 8H in Radio City, New York. There was no audience. The men, instruments in hand, sat nervously rigid, scarcely breathing. Suddenly, from a door on the right side of the stage, a small, solidly built man emerged. Immediately discernible with a crowning white hair and the impassive, square, high-cheekboned, bemustached face. He was dressed in a severely cut black alpaca jacket with a high clerical collar, formal striped trousers, and pointed slipper-like shoes. In his hand, he carried a baton. In awed stillness, we watched covertly as he walked up the few steps leading to the stage. As he stepped up to the podium, we all rose like puppets suddenly propelled to life by the pent-up tension. We had been warned in advance not to make any vocal demonstration, and we stood silent, eagerly and anxiously staring. He looked around, apparently bewildered by our unexpected action, and gestured a faint greeting with both arms, a mechanical smile lighting his pale face for an instant. Somewhat embarrassed, we sat down again. Then in a rough, hoarse voice, he called out, "Brahms!" He looked at us piercingly for the briefest moment, then raised his arms. In one smashing stroke, the baton came down, and a vibrant sound suddenly gushed forth from the tense players. With each heart-pounding timpani stroke in the opening bars of Brahms' First Symphony, his baton beat became more powerful, more insistent, his shoulders strained and hunched as though buffeting a giant wind. His outstretched left arm spasmodically flailed the air, the cupped fingers pleading like a beseeching beggar. His face reddened, muscles tightened, eyes and eyebrows constantly moving. As we in the violin section tore with our bows against our strings, I felt I was being sucked into a roaring maelstrom of sound, every bit of strength and skill called upon and strained into being. Bits of breath, muscle, and blood never before used were being drained from me. I sensed more than I heard, with near disbelief, the new sounds around me. Was this the same music we had been practicing so assiduously for days? Like ships torn from their mooring in a stormy ocean, we bobbed and tossed, responding to these earnest, importuning gestures. With what fierce new joy we played. "So, so, so," he bellowed, "cantare, sostenere." His legs were bending slightly as he braced himself for his violent movements, which were becoming larger, more pile-driving, as the music reached its first climax. "Cantare, sostenere," I was to hear these words often in the years to come. "Sing, sustain," Toscanini's battle cry. This was the first time they were flung at us, and for 17 years we lived by them. Caught up in his force, your own indifference was washed away. You were not just a player, another musician, but an artist once more searching for long-forgotten ideals and truths. You were curiously alive, and there was purpose and self-fulfillment in your work. It was not a job. It was a calling. So that was part of his opening chapter.
Wow.
So you get the feeling of his style.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'll just do a little bit from my closing piece, and that called the coda. Toscanini died in January 1957 at the age of 89. My father died suddenly, almost a year to the day later, in January 1958. He was only 49. I was only 12. It was an ordinary winter afternoon in between concert engagements. Dad was walking briskly down 57th Street on his way to a luncheon meeting. A few doors past Carnegie Hall, he fell to the sidewalk, struck down by a fatal heart attack. Within minutes, the cherished and charismatic force in our lives was gone, a flourishing career as violinist and conductor cut short. How did this happen? Had he felt ill that morning when he called out, "See you later," as I rushed out the door to school? Was his schedule too strenuous? He had recently returned home from conducting a concert in Houston, and only a couple of months earlier, he had been hailed as the new assistant conductor to Fritz Reiner, the musical director of the Chicago Symphony. The music world had surely lost a rising star, but I, only 12, had lost my hero, my protector, and my loving daddy, who beat 4/4 time with his baton while I practiced the piano, and who held my hand tightly when he walked me to school. I had lost the enthusiastic conductor who bounced up and down on his toes to the pulsing rhythm of Bizet's Carmen's March of the Toreadors. Our little family had been upended. Three had now become two. Mom and I were on our own. Through the process of compiling this new edition, Dad and I have joyfully been brought back together, creating our own duet and forming a longed for and much belated relationship. We may have only had 12 years together, but his influence and presence are deeply ingrained in who I am. There will forever be an invisible thread connecting us. After spending so much time looking through old photos, reading his letters, hearing his voice on radio interviews, and yelling, "There he is," when I catch a glimpse of him on a YouTube clip, am I able to say goodbye to him with a light heart? And what of Arturo Toscanini? I developed an unexpected soft spot for the maestro while working on this new edition. This irascible, brilliant, politically courageous, privately shy force of nature was someone I would have loved to have known. This was Toscanini, the maestro, my father, and me, as a tribute to two musicians whose paths fortuitously crossed and whose individual gifts inspired each of them in their lifelong quest to make beautiful music.
Oh. La fine. Thank you. And that was Lucy Antek Johnson reading from This Was Toscanini, the maestro, my father, and me. One of the things that I loved about this is that often with memoir about that goes back to someone's childhood, it's about childhood trauma. But that is not what this is at all. This is so sweet and loving. It's a loving memoir.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I hope that's how it's received. I do go into a little more detail about after the death and how we adjusted, but it's my mission. I said it's not about me. It will include me. I am the me in the title, and it will be about my life at that time. But I wanted my dad and certainly Toscanini to be the stars of this. So that was my effort in not dwelling too much on myself, so to speak. So thank you for recognizing that.
So Lucy, I was born in 1958, and my father also died very suddenly at 49, at age 49.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well.
Yeah. Okay. I was older. I was 22 when he died, but it was a heart attack, and he was hiking in the Grand Canyon and just went and nobody.
Oh
you
my.
Know, yeah. So.
And how different these days with medicine things could have been.
Yeah. So, yeah. I know.
Was he alone?
He was with my younger brother, who, yeah, and it was a very challenging thing for my brother.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah,
I'm so sorry to hear.
No, you can't imagine.
No, I realize.
Yeah, and left mom with five kids. Well,
wow.
three of us were adults, but two were still
it
home.
Doesn't take the pain make the pain any less. The loss is significant, and when it's sudden and a surprise, even more significant.
Yeah, and so young. It's hard to imagine.
What was his profession?
He was an engineer, but he was also an entrepreneur, and he was really into sustainable agriculture, organic farming, things like that. And he had helped start this business for commercial sprout growing, and he was on a trip that had something to do with that when he and my brother went to the Grand Canyon, and my brother and I ended up taking over that business, and I was only 22 and my brother was 21.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and things developed from there. I ended up being an entrepreneur and having several very successful businesses. So did my brother. And so who knows?
You were on the cutting edge of what's going on today, certainly.
Yeah.
Oh my, Monica.
So you never know. You know what things influenced. How things would have been different. But I feel like, I'm way past age 49 myself, and it's like if my life had been cut off that short, how much I would have missed and how much we missed,
It becomes a bar that I measure things by.
Yeah, I know. I was, once like all my siblings got past that age, it was sort of a whew.
Yes. That's how I felt about both parents.
Yeah.
About both parents. I through this journey that I took in the writing and the narration and so forth, I could appreciate as an adult, not just an adoring young daughter, who they were as people, not just parents or figures or heroes or, but who they were. And it opened up. It was very healing.
Oh, that's lovely.
I didn't expect. Go into it for that purpose. But when you immerse yourself in their lives and who they were as three-dimensional people and their hopes and dreams and joys and sorrows, it freed me up. It liberated me.
Wow.
It just did. I mean, it doesn't make me do something or act a certain way, but I look at the higher powers and I go, thank you. Thank you.
Well, it's a lovely book, both the physical book and the audio book. They each have their own strengths. As you've mentioned, the physical book with the amazing photographs.
They're good companion pieces if someone is is that interested, because you can look at the pictures and listen.
Oh, yes.
At the same time.
Yeah.
It's digital. By the way, the audiobook is digital. It's as everything is nowadays,
right,
on audio platforms. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's on, I know I saw it on Audible and I saw it on Spotify. So.
Yeah.
Caroline.
Should I mention others?
Oh, sure.
I have Barnes & Noble, Apple Books, Google Play, and something called Chirp, which I didn't know about.
So you covered all the bases.
Yeah, I have.
Caroline, do you have some a last question? We have like 1 minute left.
Well, I don't have a question, but I wanted to say this. One time her father asked the maestro, he said, "You're a brave man." Some of the boys were afraid to come up. They were on a trip. He looked at me very earnestly and said, "I have never been afraid of anything in my life. I like to try everything." And that's what he was. This man was something else. Well, so are both of these men.
Yes, but I agree with you. Because if that was the American tour, that was 1950. And Toscanini was already in his 80s, if I can do the math. And was still as energetic. I mean, he was blessed. I mean, he was blessed with a certain constitution. But he was a force of nature.
He was. Yeah, that's right. He was.
Wow. Well, Caroline, do you have a closing quote for us today? Or was that it?
That was probably it. Well, most conductors have conducted from memory, but few, if any, knew this score as Toscanini did. To him, knowing the score consisted of being conscious of every printed note, not only for itself, but in its relation to the others in the phrase, and realizing how every phrase related to the work as a whole. I mean, he was an absolute genius.
Yeah. And thank you for the work that you've done to bring him back to the attention of today.
And thank you for this conversation. It helped me, and it's, as you can imagine, one of my favorite subjects. But
of course,
I appreciate your response to what I've done and to the material.
Well, it was our pleasure, and thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.